Look at the chart I gave you. We went over this at least a couple times when we've done background or foundational studies. We did that, I think, a few summers ago. And you didn't have to memorize all this, but we did kind of require, in that class, we kind of required you to memorize some of it. Mostly the things that are in the gray is what we wanted you to kind of get into your head. I'm not very good at this, so one reason I decided to teach that class a couple times is to help me, because I'm not very good at dates and time. Just in everyday life, when we say, "Well, that, how many years ago was that? When did they come here?" And I always got 3 years, and it was like 7 or 8, you know. Always, time just seems to go so fast that I always kind of compress things. So this really helped me, and it kind of helps you to see the beginning and at least the end in terms of biblical matters. What I've done here is I took the timeline through the biblical, the period of silence apart, not up to Jesus. So when was Jesus born, by the way?
4 BCE.
Whoa, BCE. you take the liberal one.
Before Common Era.
Yeah, before the Common Era. Yeah, he was born about 4 BC, 4 or 5 BC, but I didn't put that on here. The main thing I just wanted to see was how some of these things fit in. You see Esther is way down toward the end here. We have Esther, Nehemiah, and Ezra, all kind of contemporaries. And usually if you buy a commentary, they'll deal with those three books together. We did a Bible study once about courage and how to deal with tribulation, things like that, and studied those three books. It's almost the close of the Old Testament period. Where was Ruth? Where would we put Ruth on this chart? Did I put much?
King Tut.
Yeah. Yeah, and we don't know the date. All we know is the period of the judges. So sometimes from about 1375 BC to the time of the king from 1050. Anyway, I just did this because I thought about it. And
I was going to Hercules. You said you
know, Hercules.
Yeah, how did Hercules go?
I don't know. Why not? Steve Reeves, you know. Who was Superman?
George Reeves.
I always get those guys mixed up. One time,
Christopher Reeve.
Christopher Reeve, yeah.
Yeah, Christopher Reeve.
George Reeves first, though.
I thought it was Dean Cain.
Thought it was what?
Until he ended up in the wheelchair.
Call it overnight right there.
Yeah. I'm not sure how Hercules got on here, to tell you the truth. I don't know. I just thought it was probably.
Maybe that was when it was written, the story of Hercules?
Well, I mean, that's when he's supposed to be, I guess, the legend or whatever. Trying to give you something to touch base with here on this stuff. And then all the prophets are in here, so that, at least the. Well, most. All the writing prophets, and then you have Nathan and Elijah and Elisha and some of those as well. So it's kind of handy to have. At one point, I made this a smaller version of this. I didn't have all these details in here, but I made it into a card and keep it in your Bible. Sometimes it helps to keep these things straight. And it's amazing when you go through the history, you see how everything hangs together, especially when you run it all the way through Revelation, through the New Testament period. Anyway, moving on. Let's go through this. And if you have any questions or comments as we go through this by way of review, in each of these chapters, then by all means, let me know and comment. We know that Xerxes threw a party. How long was the party?
6 months.
6 months. Yeah, 6 months and 7 days. Then Vashti also was throwing a party. And then he told Vashti to come in and show herself, and she refused. Why do you think she refused?
She was busy.
She was busy throwing her own party.
Yeah.
Probably something more to it than that. Probably what he was asking her to do is probably the main reason. And he's enraged. And I think he brought out on Sunday how often we read that. People are mad a lot in this book. The bad guys, or at least some of the people, the pagan people are people who get enraged a lot. The Jews get sad and upset. Mimikon reasons that all wives will feel emboldened to disobey husbands, so that's what that, you see how these, well, really want to go through all this, because this is called setting, it's setting all this stuff in motion, and that brings us into chapter 4, and one thing after another. And so they issue an edict, and what is it about, I guess I have it under there, about Persian edicts, Persian commands?
Never.
You can't repeal them, so as you see on the bottom there, the bullet point. So that law is passed, and the law is that every man is master of his house. That's the law. We don't have anything like that in our Constitution. Not sure we want to, but that's the way it is. Okay. Then chapter 2, after these things, and so he remembered Vashti. What might be the reason that he remembered Vashti at this Vashti point?
Back from war.
Maybe back from war. That's speculation by a lot of scholars. I think, okay, maybe he came back because it is a time period fits. Came back from his being defeated. Eventually, at Salamis, Thermopylae had that problem with the Spartans there and all of that. And so he comes back and he remembers her. Now, we talked about this. I think it's kind of interesting as we think about Vashti. We have a pagan king here who has this one woman that, of course, is his queen. So you think that's the only woman he had?
He had a harem,
it says. They had multiple women, and of course, even Solomon had a bunch of wives and concubines and things. But there was one that stands out and one that is special and made king. Now, the real name of Xerxes' wife was something like Amarista or something like that. And so this name actually means best or better or beauty or something along that line, apparently. So it's more of a descriptive name, apparently, than her actual name, according to the historians. But he remembered her. So he remembered there's something about her that made her stand out. And that kind of builds on that in the story, because as they go looking for other women, other beautiful women, but also women who apparently have the character that he wants in somebody that he would make a queen. So it's not just about the sex and women and stuff. It's about the particular person who is fit to be his queen, right? So anyway, he remembers her. So then, let beautiful virgin be sought out for the king. So they go throughout the whole kingdom and look for somebody to replace her. That's the whole point of this. Because they made that decree, she can never return to the king. She's off limits now. The king couldn't even undo that. So we meet Mordecai. Who's Mordecai? What's his? How does he figure in this story as we move along here?
Is that the right definition of cousin?
Is that what?
Is that the right definition of his relationship, a cousin?
It's his uncle's daughter. I'm really bad at that too, but I think we've decided that's what it is. If it's his uncle's daughter, I'm really dumb when it comes to some of this stuff. What I had to do is think about my uncle's daughter, and she's a cousin. My uncle Ernie has a daughter, Jan, and she's my cousin. Okay, so that's what I figured it out.
But he took her in as if she were his own daughter.
Daughter, yes. Yeah. She probably a much older cousin. I was kind of the third or fourth in our family of the cousins. I had older cousins, but I got some really young people. You know, I had cousins that were 20 years older, and that could be. She's Hadassah is her real name, is Esther's real name, actually, her Jewish name. And so she's taken to the king's palace. She finds favor with everybody, as it turns out, not only with the Hegai, who's the kind of the eunuch in charge, and then she wins favor with everyone. She's keeping her identity a secret, and why did she do that, or why did Mordecai tell her to do that? What do you think, at this point, does it Does it seem to make any difference?
I assume he feels it's not to her advantage to let that be known.
Yeah.
We can speculate on why, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about that too much before until, kind of the third time around with this. I'm thinking, well, okay, why did he tell her at that point? What, they're taking, they've got all this territory, they got this land, they're bringing women from everywhere. And anyway, he commands her, basically, not to do that, and she obeys. We have an obedient, kind of a string of obedience through this, and disobedience that runs through this story, right? You have people disobeying and people obeying, and she's obedient. And this is one the first instance of that. And then Mordecai keeps tabs on her. He kind of sits outside the gate and kind of watches over her. So he doesn't just kind of abandon her once she goes into the palace. He's still concerned about her. But just stop for a minute. What do we know? We talked a lot about character. What are we saying here with Mordecai in terms of his character? In fact, let's back up a minute. What is character? We say that person is a person of good character. What are we talking about? What?
I said integrity.
Oh, okay, integrity. Yeah, integrity's very important to that, meaning they're honest and authentic and genuine, all those kinds of things, right? That's a person of character. What do we see with Mordecai? Seems to be a man of integrity.
Mm-hmm. Responsible.
Responsible. He's clearly responsible for here. He's taken her as a daughter. I'm sure he's okay. I assume he's okay with her going in and being the queen, as it turns out. But he doesn't just move on then. He continues to watch over her. And then we'll see more as we move through, especially in chapter 4, where he talks to her and kind of urges her to make a certain decision, the decision to go to the king. He's a man of integrity. And we see it also in the way he reacts when he finds out about the decree against the Jews. After a year, Esther went to the king, won his favor, and became queen in the place of Vashti. So those are the things that's chapter 2. And then he overhears a plot to kill the king, and he reports that. How does he report that?
Through Esther.
But then she tells him in Mordecai's name. That's going to come up later on. That's pretty important as the story moves along. Okay, we've talked about all that stuff. So as we move into chapter 3, we meet Haman. Again, who's Haman? He's the Agagite. And what did we say about why is that important? Why is that kind of interesting anyway? That he's an Agagite.
Why is it? The descendant of Agag. Saul.
Yeah, back in 1 Samuel 15, when he was supposed to go, when Saul was supposed to go and kill all the Amalekites, it says, verse 7 says, Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites alive, and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen. So when Samuel comes to him, do you remember what he says? You remember this story? I know some preachers preach on every other Sunday, but I don't. I haven't. Do you remember when Samuel comes to him and meets Saul, and Saul immediately says,
I've done everything the Lord told me to.
I kept a command that everything that the Lord told me. And then so what's Samuel's response to that? Classic.
So what's the lowing of the sheep?
What's the bleeding of the sheep I hear?
And the oxen.
It's kind of comical. Christy kind of got us off. She's sick with my cold now. So, but she kind of got us off on Sunday about the hacking of Agag. She kind of got off on that from her own. But before Samuel hacked him to pieces, he apparently had. I mean, he had descendants that then were crop up here and all the way down here in 480. The story of Esther. So that's just kind of rich. I don't know the whole thing.
But do you think he knew that history?
The writer?
No, the writer didn't. No, I'm asking, do you think that Haman knew that?
Oh, Haman?
History, and had some vengeance against the Jews due to that situation.
Well, what we read is that he's the son of Hamadath, who's an enemy of the Jews. Remember that? Verse 10, right?
Yeah,
of chapter 3?
Was that just describing him, or is that talking about his relative?
It's talking about his dad, I guess. So the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. So if his dad was the enemy of the Jews, you could be sure that, you know, like father like son, right? Kind of thing. So there's a, he's been raised anti-Semitic, as they say today.
Yeah, but is that just describing his heredity, or was it Haman that was the enemy of the Jews?
Well, I think it was the son. I took it as Hammedatha, who his father was, and then it says the enemy of the Jews. I took that to mean Hammedatha was an enemy of the Jews. Is that, I mean, is there how much?
Well, it seems that the writer is pointing it out for a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to make sense that, you know, there seems to be some hatred here that's going on between.
Yeah, it's not just that Haman doesn't bow down to him. There's something already brewing and is percolating, right?
I think we could suspect that if it was just he was just irritated with Mordecai, his response later wouldn't have been to destroy all of the Jews, but right. Just taking care of this guy.
Yes.
That seems to be a clue that there was animosity there already.
Right. And I think the adding that he's the Agagite, I think at least three times, is a clue as well to those who are Bible students and remember the history. That he's saying, you can remember way back when, maybe 1,000 years ago, or modern anyway, 500 years ago, when they didn't wipe out the Amalekites completely, and Agag was still there. Now he's cropping up again, causing problems to the Jews. So, yeah, I do think that's probably right. There's animus here against them.
Regarding the reading, though, I mean, there's no punctuation in the original version of these scriptures, right? So, I mean, no. You could read it either way. Either Hammedatha was the enemy of the Jews or Haman was the enemy of the Jews. The point is,
somebody was. There was, yes?
Seems like on Sunday we were talking about if it was possible, and I thought a lot about this, if it was possible that Haman knew their family history, because we talked a lot about that with Agag, and then he was a descendant of Mordecai being a descendant of Saul.
Mm-hmm.
And but I, from what when we read about when Haman was upset, it says there's like kind of a progression. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they made known to him the people of Mordecai. So he didn't initially know even that Mordecai was a Jew. So I don't think he really knew who Mordecai was. Because then after they told him, hey, that guy that's not bowing to you, he's a Jew. Then he said, then he just stopped to destroy all the Jews and the people of Mordecai throughout the whole kingdom. He's like, he's a Jew, man, I hate those people.
Yeah.
Let's just take
I've always hated those people.
Stone, you know?
Yeah.
My dad taught me to hate
my dad and maybe my grandpa hated those people. You know, right. Going back 10 generations, we hated those people. Yeah, I think that's right. It's a good observation because it's unfolding out to him, and then he said in verse 4, Haman, in order to see what Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told him that he was a Jew. So I don't know.
The servants.
Yeah, the servants, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. The servants said, "Hey, why aren't you obeying the king's command?" He's right. Like, "Because I'm a Jew." So then they went to Haman to see if the words would stand. Right?
Yeah. Good point. And we did have that conversation too a little bit on Sunday about, okay, what should he? Was he warranted in not bowing down to Haman? And then we kind of went into the Pledge of Allegiance, you know. But what were you gonna say?
Oh, I just feel that I think he was pushing it, his Jewish being really hard not to bow down to Haman. I mean,
okay,
there are certain things that are clearly. A Jew should not bow down to like golden images and that kind of stuff. I mean, he was pushing it.
Pushing, okay, yeah.
He probably didn't like him a whole lot either.
Yeah. Well,
it's interesting because I thought that too. Like, we talked about Haman being Mordecai being so wise, and I'm like, I don't know if he was that wise. It kind of seems like he's kind of.
You get the whole Jewish.
Making a pretty good point about this thing.
So. Yeah, that's it's an interesting. One thing I read, well, yeah, it'd be breaking the first and second commandment, you know. But. I don't know if it's that clear. And I looked at 1 Peter 2 where it says honor the king, right? I mean, we're supposed to honor, and that was Caesar, who was an ungodly king, that when Peter wrote that, I guess it depends on what honor means and what that bowing down involves, perhaps. Dana?
Apparently, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all bow down and pay homage to Nebuchadnezzar, and assumably anyone else that was in the command, just mm-hmm. not the statue.
Yeah,
right?
Not
they,
the statue.
They made that the distinction. Yes. So it seems like maybe it's a matter of conscience.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good discussion here, because we do pledge allegiance to the flag. You know what we're doing? What are we doing? We're pledging. I've done it. We do it from the time we're little kids, you know? Under God, we even say that. And there is at least one religious group that refuses to do that, one so-called Christian religious group. Obviously, others don't, but there's... So, 1 Peter 2 and Romans 13 are very clear about obeying the authorities that are above you, the governmental authorities. We're supposed to obey those. So
that's less clear in the Old Testament, though.
It's less clear in the Old Testament, but there is the Daniel situation.
Yeah, Daniel, O King, live forever, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, again, we're at one of those places where there are a lot of open questions here, just as we had in Ruth. There's a lot of questions. Don't go into detail about this. He doesn't say why he didn't. There might have been more here then that we don't know in terms of why he didn't do that or why he felt he couldn't do it. Maybe it's because of Haman himself and what he knew about him. I don't know. But if he should have or could have, I'll put it this way, if he could have, he risked the whole Jewish nation by not doing it. That's what this amounts to. So, and by extension, then his own cousin is Esther. And put her in a really bad spot.
And to me, that's where the reason why, and obviously the story's parsing out Mordecai, so that might be the only reason, but at the beginning of chapter 4, when he learns all that's been done, not that you want to be upset that all your people are going to be killed anyway, right? And so it's told through Mordecai's eyes in that case. But it's almost personal the way he is wearing sackcloth and ashes, the way he mourns. It's almost like, look what I've done.
Yeah, kind of I see what you're saying, You get a guilt, maybe some guilt about it. Could be. So what's fascinating about these short stories is there's lots of directions we could go.
Yeah. I read a few commentaries in between today and Wednesday, and a lot of them made a big deal about his Agagiteness.
Agagiteness?
His a couple of them said that Mordecai understood him to be the modern incarnation of the Amalekites.
Oh, okay.
And that potentially could have had something to do with his refusal to bow down to him, but I don't know. There's a lot of theories abound as to why he wouldn't do it, especially when you look at the Old Testament, there are instances where the Jews did bow down to those in authority.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting and ironic that he didn't. So yeah. I was trying to come up with some sort of reasoning as to why he wouldn't, because it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, it might have been his agagitis. If he knew his family history, if he'd been looking through the, you know, the scrapbook, came back. From...
I mean, he wasn't a closet guy. Everyone knew who Haman was. I mean, he was the chief of staff, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was bigwig in the city, in the town, in Susa.
I think that when we look at what various people did and didn't do in these narratives and these events in the Old Testament. Unless the Bible says that what they did was the right thing to do, which it doesn't usually say that. I mean, I think that similar to today, people do what they think is the right thing to do. And so whether Mordecai was, whether God expected him to not bow down or not, Mordecai obviously thought that it would be the wrong thing to do, because when the servants asked him, Mordecai had told them that the reason why was because he was a Jew. Mm-hmm. Now it doesn't say because in here, but I think we can infer that. And just like when Daniel, what the phrase was that Roy used, Nebuchadnezzar live forever. I don't think that we can say that every single thing that Daniel did was the exact perfect thing to do. I think just like any of us, he does what he thinks is right, and then later he, you know, maybe he should have showed a little less homage to Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know. But I think that we, have to be careful in saying, oh, because this person, this upright person did it, they were right. And because this upright person did something, they were right. So how do we reconcile it? I mean...
No, you're right. You're on to something there. Because we, the more I study the Old Testament, the more I want to do it in smaller classes. You know what I mean? Like this. Because there's so much that is open to... And again, you know, a lot of these... I don't know, we were talking about this last Sunday, but a lot of these stories that we're told that come out of the Old Testament and that were preached on, and then there's a whole lot of questions. If you're sitting there as a brand new person and never heard this stuff before, and it just say, whoa, wait, you know. And the example I use is Elisha and the youths who come out and call him bald head. You know, some of us in here are a little sensitive to that, but we probably, a lot of us looks like, actually. we have quite a few here. And, you know, but I don't think we would sick, you know, 42 she-bears on them, you know, just because they said, go, you up, bald head. But those stories are preached kind of a comical way. And if somebody's sitting there that has never heard that before, and what kind of monster does this, you know, you're exalting Elisha because was Elisha even right in doing that? I mean, it seemed like it'd be a miracle. So just had God's help in doing that. And there's probably a whole lot more going on there. But I'm just, you know what I'm saying? This is let's get right to it here. Does Esther go into the king? I mean, does she have sex with him?
I think so.
Obviously, yes.
Whatever
you would think
doing,
so.
They're there all night long.
She goes in.
She's just sleeping on his feet.
Yeah.
That's what all of the concubines are doing.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that because. Because I think it's worth emphasizing that this whole thing is a terribly immoral thing, and it's not like these girls signed up for it. They're basically enslaved,
yes.
Put into this assembly, the moral assembly line,
okay.
And they're in the assembly line. And it seems pretty clear to me that she submitted to it.
They didn't. There's something really strange, right?
Zero choice.
Yeah.
Death or dishonor.
If you read these little... Beth, what's her name? Some of these ladies,
Moore.
Beth Moore, or some of these women's study books. You know, the little fluffy ones. You know, everybody's purified. You know, these things, because Esther, she couldn't have. You know, they even made a movie about it. I don't think, and the movie, it was Pure Flix movie, I think. So it was one of those, and it was called A Night with the King, and I don't think. They left the impression that she slept with him, you know, in that. I think they kind of kept that, they purified that thing. So, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the Old Testament that's just really hard to explain. And I'm reading a really good book on it right now, but it's one thing, the point he made is just, he says, there's a lot of questions in there, but it's kind of like having a friend. You know, you have this friend that you're reading through these stories, and you're not reading things into them just so that you can make everybody kind of come out like that. You want them to come out. You read it like a story, like you would any other story. And the characters, and you take things at face value unless there's some reason not to. And then we could talk about it. Esther going in as a slave to go in and do what she did. And then you could talk about the wisest man in the world having 700 wives and 300 concubines. I mean, so... You know, we deal with that, and as I say, everybody in here is mature enough to try to sort through all that kind of thing and realize that when you come to the New Testament, we find that what these people did and the way they lived, and I mean, it was not ideal. it wasn't what God had intended to start with, and we see all the fallout from it, the fallout from David and all the mistakes he made, even though he was supposed to be a man after God's own heart. So he wasn't a man after God's own heart when he was sleeping with Bathsheba. That was a statement made before that when he was chosen to be king. But he always came back to God. He kept coming back to God. So we have to read it as, and you know, you guys all know this. We read the Old Testament as grown-ups. You know, we're not reading, these aren't, the thing is, we've taken so many of the stories and made them in little children's books, more or less, little children's stories. And some of them aren't. really children's stories. Not, and some of those kids, some of our kids are pretty smart. It was somebody just recently, within the last month or so, that kind of stopped the whole thing about David. They were having a class about David, and he said, and I forget who it was, I remember. Anyway, he said, why did David have 7 wives? Some little kid, you know, up here at Folsom, one of your kids or somebody, you know, I don't know which one. But it was just like, boom. And you go, yeah, well, and then, of course, the teacher's trying to, how do you explain that to a second grader? You know, exactly. So, but they know that. So what are you going to do with that? You know, just kind of try to gloss it all over? That's not, I'm glad they can ask questions like that because they feel they should do. Ben and I, and in our class, we've had lots of conversations about this in Ruth and all the stuff going on in Ruth there. That's interesting.
I'm just glad 1,000 years later they're not doing the whole brother going into sister-in-laws anymore. That whole
yeah, the old,
that weirded me out.
That would be weird. I know. Just the stuff that's in the law, and you know, I know
it's
just
in the law too. You're like, what is going on?
Oh man, I know. Me too. Yeah. It'd be a lot more cheating to have only children, probably. My wife's an only child.
Okay, move on.
Yeah, tell me about your brother-in-law. Tell me about your brother. All right. Okay, so chapter 3, then. Let's just review that because we're going to go in chapter 4 at some point. So he's an Agagite, and Mordecai refused to bow down to him, and Haman is filled with fury. So we got more anger stuff going on, you know, more fireworks. Yes?
I just have thought it was interesting that Mordecai did exactly what he told Esther not to do by saying, I'm a Jew.
To say, by saying what?
That he's a Jew.
He did own up to it, yeah. Yeah, I know. So he didn't want the king's... He didn't want that in the palace. He didn't want that knowledge in the palace for whatever reason. It came. It was a good thing, as it turns out, I guess. But I guess, you know, as all the story moves forward here. But yeah, that's interesting. He blurts it out. So, and then he seeks to kill all the Jews, and they cast lots for a year. I don't understand that. I'll be honest with you. I don't really know what they were doing here in verse 7 exactly. I mean, I know what it says. They cast lots for day by day before Haman for a year. So somebody can shed light on that.
I'm always assuming, just a guess, that they were, you know, seeking the propitious day. The whole, you know, a lot of that augury type of stuff in ancient history. That they were casting, and it took a whole year to find the right day for him to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, that you can concur with that.
You know, one thing that I guess maybe we see again, there might be some providence involved, is that date was pushed out far enough that there was time for the Jewish people to do something.
Yeah.
You know, the way the lots came up, I guess the lots could have came up where it was going to be, you know, 3 weeks out or 2 weeks out, but it was out quite a ways.
Yeah, yeah. It gets all the way to the end of the year, right? So,
yeah.
So, yeah. And that's interesting because you think if he's so enraged and he wanted to kill all the Jews, you wouldn't about it, you know, get with it. But I guess they really put a lot in those lots, right? They put a lot to get. So, and this becomes the Feast of Purim later on for the Jews. I read later, we'll get into this later on, but I thought I read something some time back. That the Feast of Purim is the only feast in which the Jews are authorized to get as drunk as they can get. I mean, that's
really,
and the new version of that, I guess, so they're free to drink all they want and kind of party, and also, I don't know what that has to do with anything, but that's why this feast comes up is all the way back into, you know, most of the feast days, of course, were established in the law, and this comes up because of Esther. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's kind of what I thought, but I thought this seems like there's more to it than that. There's something, but I guess there's not. I just kind of come waiting for something the day to come up. Sort of like the Buddhists do when to figure out what day you should get married. I had a friend that he was supposed to get married on December 19th. And they, his fiancée, and they'd been going together for a couple of years, but that was today. So, I don't know if they cast lots or what. But so, Haman's king is, he gets the decree, and he pays 10,000 talents, which is like, yes. But.
Well, I was just going to, on that point, that's what's really interesting about this, is how he entices the king very carefully. He's a smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
One, on his power, these people don't follow the same laws. And it is, we don't know for sure, but it's interesting that Xerxes is really quick to say, yes, you can take them all out. So it must not be a surprise to him that Jewish people, when you say earlier, when we ask earlier, did why hide it? It could be because there was things against them, and they had been drug out, and they were following other gods and didn't follow the same rules, because he was quick to do that. Mm-hmm. Secondly, is the money side of it. I mean, if he's gone to war, he's probably low on funds. We find out in chapter 2, he gets rid of the tax. He's probably low on funds. And 10,000 is a lot. That's like millions.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
It's a huge amount.
Yes,
so it is interesting that he uses power and money to entice
him. Yeah.
To this decree.
Entices a lot of people. Aren't those the two things that in all criminal activity? I mean, it comes down to one of those or both, right? I mean, with the cartels, it's about power and money, right? It's what it's all about. So, yeah, and that is interesting, and I think that's one at least piece of evidence maybe that he is after he came back from a very costly war against the Greeks that even she lost, and so he needs the bucks, he needs the money. Although he turns it back, he says you can use that money. He turns it back and says, you can use that money to carry out your thing, too. So, but he knows that he'll get, if you wipe out all the Jews, and you're getting all their stuff, all their money. So he wouldn't worry about that. I think that also probably entered into it, at least subconsciously. Okay, we'll get their spoil when they're gone. Okay, any other thoughts on that? Yes.
I have a question, because I think you just answered it, but I want to make sure. So in verse 9, Esther 3:9.
Mm-hmm.
Where Haman says, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work. And then the next clause says, to bring it into the king's treasuries.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't get that, because it sounds like Haman's saying, I will pay and then and bring it into the king's treasuries. So that verse I thought was kept. I thought was saying he's paying money into the king's treasuries, but then the next verse says that the king gave the money to Haman, you know, to give to the people who do the work. So up is verse 9 where it says to bring it into the king's treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
Is that talking about the spoils from the Jews? Those will go into the king's treasury? So the king is giving Haman the money that's necessary to pay the people doing the killing, and then the spoils will go into the king's treasury?
Well, I think I just say that would be a result. I think it's mentioned later on that they would take the spoils. But I think this is saying, Haman's saying, I'll give you 10 grand. You got this. I'll give you 10K of talents of gold, 10,000 talents of gold for the privilege of killing all the Jews. And he says, and you know, you put that in the king's treasury. Then the king turns around. I'm reading this. King turns around and says, okay, you have the right to do that, and you can use the money too. Probably not going to take 10,000 talents.
He needed some resources to do it, though.
Yeah, he needs some resources to carry it out. So you can use that money, and then they all knew there. If you kill all the Jews, you're getting all their money, all their resources. Well, so,
and it may be confusing the way verse 9 is written. Remember, this is a God king. He didn't do anything. Everybody did stuff for him, whether it was taking care of the women or taking care of his treasuries. Right? He was worshipped as a god, treated like that. Nobody touched him. Nobody messed with him. So that's why it's written like that. Of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it in the king's treasuries, right?
His bankers.
His bankers.
His money men.
His CPA. I probably reading the ESV. That's probably my problem.
Because
that sounds much clearer than what I was reading.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's a handlers everywhere, right? The handlers of the women, the handlers of there's a lot of eunuchs running around.
He might have been treated quite so good after Salamis.
Yeah, after the loss of And eventually, they lost to the Greeks, never attacked the Greeks again. The Greeks took over later, and so they were hurting from that standpoint, definitely. Brian?
Some of the things we talked about tonight harken back to Ruth, in the sense that, he's Mordecai's advising her, don't reveal that you're a Jew. It just reminds me of him, Boaz saying to Ruth, well, wait till the morning, but slip out before people are about. And there's some parallels there, it feels like.
There are, yeah. I think that's what motivates some of the studying these together. I mean, not just the fact there's two women, but the fact that there are a lot of intriguing things going on here, and a lot of these you don't know. We can't answer for sure. I mean, I don't find that frustrating. I find it fascinating. I used to find it frustrating.
I mean, Boaz and Mordecai both seem to be pretty shrewd guys who have character, show character.
Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, right? As Jesus said, kind of. They portray that? Did the bell ring?
Yep. No.
No? Okay. No, it will. Isn't that right? Okay, so we're going to get into chapter 4 on Sunday. And we're going to spend more time in chapter 4, especially the latter part, because I think that's where the application of this is, most of it. I will mail out. I have some hard copies here. A few of them, if you want them. I also will. I'll email it out. So you have it.
So did you guys make your connection last night?
You were delayed and you were
Yes.